Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast. The world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history. Hello everyone and welcome to the Mariner's Mirror podcast. We are thick in one of our busiest weeks yet. On this day in 1940 was one of the most important amphibious operations and evacuations in history, when the British Expeditionary Force and other Allied troops were evacuated from the beaches of Dunkirk to save them from the rapidly approaching German forces who had just launched their lightning invasion of Northern Europe. It is an extraordinary story, and there is no better man to tell it than Dr. Phil Weir, author of Dunkirk and the Little Ships, published by Shire Books. Philip Weir is a historian who specialises in the Royal Navy in the early 20th century. He has written for the Navy Record Society, History Today and Time, and has contributed to television and radio programmes, including the BBC's Who Do You Think You Are? Above all, however, he is a titan in the world of social media, a man at the centre of a web of naval specialists all over the world. You can, and you certainly should, all follow him on Twitter, at Naval Historian. Let's set the scene from Phil's book. During 1940, the German army swept with devastating speed across the Low Countries and into northern France and drove Allied forces back into a small pocket around Dunkirk. Without a swift withdrawal across the English Channel, the latter faced certain death or capture. The evacuation plan, Operation Dynamo, initially calculated that 45,000 men might be rescued. But between the 26th of May and the 4th of June, 338,226 men were in fact brought back to England. Naval historian Phil Weir shows how this was made possible by a vast armada of disparate vessels, including destroyers, minesweepers, fishing vessels, and most famously of all, the privately owned little ships. He explores the vessels' various roles within the evacuation and their subsequent fates, including preservation and participation in commemorative return runs to the port, which now take place every 5 years. Well, to tell you more, here is the man himself, Dr. Phil Weir. Right, Phil, Dunkirk, May 1940.
Indeed.
Set the scene. What was happening?
Well, at that point, really, Britain, the Allies, are in something of a political crisis. You've had the French Prime Minister has had to resign, been replaced due to basically problems over the Soviet invasion of Finland, which the Allies, the British and the French, didn't really intervene to assist the Finns. And then you've also got the invasion of Norway in April, which the Allied counter to which doesn't go terribly well, which causes a political crisis in Britain. And by the 10th of May, you've got a problem whereby the Prime Minister of Britain, Neville Chamberlain, is facing a vote of no confidence, famously, and he is forced to step down. However, it is at that very moment that, of course, Adolf Hitler chooses to invade France.
Right. And what's the kind of the immediate response to that in the UK?
There are various responses, really. It's you've got Churchill as the new Prime Minister, but a lot of things spring into action pretty immediately. For the British forces on the continent, they are under the command of the French General Maurice Gamelin, so under French command, and immediately the Germans cross the border, the Belgians call for assistance from the Allies, and British and French forces move up into Belgium. They also move across into the Netherlands, which has also been invaded, and there's interesting little naval manoeuvre in there, in fact, where you have a force at sea of the cruiser HMS Birmingham and an escort of destroyers on the lookout, generally, for German ships, predominantly for mine layers, and they are immediately ordered to the Dutch coast to go and sweep down there, because, of course, the fear is, much as had happened with the invasions of Denmark and Norway, that the Germans would also put in an amphibious effort and go round down the coast, potentially into the Netherlands. Germans actually don't, but the British send down this force of cruisers and destroyers to sweep up and destroy anything that's in sight, and thereafter follow up with minesweepers in order to keep the Dutch ports clear, because, of course, the Netherlands have got some fantastic ports, and the French are essentially determined to use them, and they use them to send chunks of the Seventh Army across to the port of Lissingen. So essentially they do what the Germans, they feared the Germans would do, but obviously the Germans couldn't. And if they tried, they'd probably have been sunk.
What were the naval powers at the time in that area then? So it wasn't just the British and the Germans, was it?
It's predominantly the British and the Germans in that area, but obviously the French have got a quite considerable navy of their own as well. Although largely because the situation in the Mediterranean is deteriorating with Italy, much of the French navy is now has been shifted towards the Mediterranean, and the British have actually had to recreate their own Mediterranean fleet as well, because outbreak of war in September 39, the Mediterranean fleet is not quite disbanded, but very much truncated down to really a cruiser force, as the battleships and the aircraft carriers are brought back to the home fleet. But that has to reverse itself as sort of April and May continue. But yes, the French do have a notable naval force of their own. There's a couple of old battleships, First World Wars, destroyers, a couple of cruisers in the Atlantic Fleet. And so there is a substantial naval force. And it's basically the Allies really have naval dominance down that coast.
What about the Dutch? Is there Dutch ships?
Absolutely, yes. Of course, the Dutch have very... It's a small but very highly competent navy. And it is of the Dutch armed forces probably in the best shape. I mean, obviously, throughout the interwar period, everyone's kind of suffered a bit from defence cuts and retrenchment after the First World War, and the Dutch are no different. But 1930s, they all see potentially war coming and money starts to be spent. But the Dutch Navy, yeah, it's highly competent, it's small. A lot of it is actually based out in the Netherlands, East Indies, but they've got a number of pretty advanced ships that are predominantly still under construction, actually in the Netherlands. And beyond that, and when the Germans invade, then certain arrangements that have already been made, and have to bear in mind that this is an arrangement that was also made with the Polish Navy in 1939, they start to withdraw back to Britain to fight on alongside Britain to essentially keep their navy safe and keep the navy fighting, because the fear is they'll get potentially caught in port and just sunk. Now, the most modern destroyer they've got, the Van Galen, and I apologise for any...
Very convincing.
for Dutch, any Dutch listeners for my Dutch pronunciation, the Van Galen is sent in to try and bombard German forces ashore, but is unfortunately sunk in the process. Much of the rest of the navy, led by an older cruiser, but most of the sort of part-built ships, and not all of them are completed by any stretch of the imagination, pull out really from the 11th of May onwards and go across to the Medway, where they are taken in by the British and in many cases completed and their sort of technology and so forth handed over to incorporated into the Allies. So
yeah, see, there are different, you know, naval forces around. It's absolutely not just the UK. And the
Belgium's got a fairly small coastal force. So the Dutch are the primary ones, the French as well. But yeah, it's also the and obviously the Royal Navy. So yeah, there are a number of naval forces that obviously the Dutch had been neutral up to this point, and all of a sudden on the 10th they are immediately incorporated into the
Allies. And there's plenty of fishing boats as well. I just want to give the impression that there's there's quite a lot of traffic in the channel. There are a lot of boats around, aren't there?
Yeah, and there's quite a bit of traffic, and it's not just fishing boats. I mean, obviously you find with a lot of or at least a significant chunk of the British fishing fleet as in the First World War, a lot of them have been taken up into naval services, anti-submarine trawlers, minesweepers, and so forth. Similarly, the French and the Belgians and the Dutch have taken up a number of theirs as well. So you've got the fishing fleets, you've got a lot of cross-channel traffic, notably to even support the British Expeditionary Force, the British Army ashore. They are transported across initially from the sort of first couple of days of the war.
So this is just as soon as the Germans have invaded, the British Expeditionary Force is then sent across.
As soon as war was declared in 1939, the British Expeditionary Force is sent across. This is really remarkably quickly after the invasion of Poland. Within a couple of days, they start sending men across, and the initial arrivals are actually the RAF. I think they actually even arrived the day before war is declared, and in order to try and preempt any surprise attack by the Germans. But
the crucial point is that they've been dropped off in France, yeah, and then the boats, the ships that dropped them off, have then returned to the UK. So there isn't, the shipping which took that army there is not sitting around waiting to pick them up again.
There is a degree of yes and no in fact, because there is obviously sort of unit rotation to go through. So there is always some traffic going on, and there is a need to support the army with munitions, with other supplies, and so forth from Britain. So actually, under the Dover command, under Vice Admiral Ramsay, whose headquarters at Dover Castle, there are still a number of ships actually sat in there just going back and forth across the channel to support the British Expeditionary Force.
So it's like a kind of umbilical cord.
Yeah. Most of that tends, in fact, to go less directly across the channel, although there is some really sort of the Dover to Dunkirk. A lot of it tends to be more slightly further back with the Portsmouth to Cherbourg, Havre, those sorts of places, because this was a request of the French, because they wanted British supply ports to support the army to be further back. Predominantly because they were afraid that the Germans would basically bomb the ports and cause problems that way if they were too close to the German border. So the theory was that if the import ports for the expeditionary force were a bit further up the coast in Normandy, then Allied air defences would be able to pick them up and pick any raiders up, and hopefully less or no damage would be caused to the supply lines. So, yeah, there is still a fair bit of traffic going across. The army, it's ever-growing. I mean, obviously, the first tranche is really sort of only there's a couple of divisions, I think. By the time you reach the German invasion of France and Belgium in May 1940, it's up to about 10 divisions. And, I mean, there's that's sort of primarily the fighting men. You've got also with that the rear echelons, the supply guys and so forth. And it's sort of heading for, you know, 500,000 men.
Wow, an immense amount of people. And then it all goes wrong.
Yes, it very, very quickly goes wrong. The French General Gamelin, he's got this grand plan, this grand idea that that obviously his forces will steam into Belgium and intercept the Germans, you know, as they come through Belgium, and the war would be fought in Belgium. Now, obviously, the really grand plan, the famous bit, is the Maginot Line, mm-hmm. About which many jokes are told, of course, about it being too short and all the rest of it. Most of them are kind of not quite accurate.
Well, the specific point is that it doesn't go to the sea.
Yes, it doesn't. There are various reasons for that: expense, politics, and a few other bits and pieces. But it basically actually does what they intend it to do. And what they intend it to do is ensure that there is no direct invasion of France, i.e. that they will fight the next war not on French soil, but on Belgian soil. It's all about, if you're not going to build the wall right the way up to the sea on the French border, then it's all about effectively kind of using Belgium as your buffer zone.
Yeah.
And that's the plan. What it relies upon, of course, if they're not going to go through the Maginot Line, which they don't, you've got to guess which route through Belgium they take. And obviously there's this marvellous sort of flat plain right the way through the centre of Belgium, the Jean Blot Gap, which is a traditional invasion route. In fact, entertainingly, when war is declared in September 39, there is a certain amount of friction, shall we say, between the French and neutral Belgium, because the French sit there and say, well, in order to really run a successful counter-invasion of France to help our Polish allies, we need to get through Belgium. We've got to go through the Jean Blot Gap. And the Belgians say, no. And therefore, there's only a sort of minor invasion between the two defensive lines, between the Maginot Line and his German opposite number, which doesn't last terribly long and doesn't go terribly far. So this is the chosen route. This is the one that Gamelin would have used himself if he'd been allowed, and this is the one that he thinks that the Germans are going to use when they come through. And indeed, actually, it really is. This is the German plan, right up until the point where a couple of German majors out and about on a little jolly in an aircraft crash land in the middle of Belgium with a full set of the plans, rather forcing a fairly dramatic rethink to the proposals put forward by von Manstein to essentially go through the Ardennes. As they famously end up doing. Now, as with all of these things, there is this sort of grand precedent, and the French have actually exercised it. One of their generals, André Gaston Pretelat, in 1936 or 1938, I think it is, he's in charge of the attacking force in this big exercise that they run, and he figures out that if you go through the Ardennes, you can probably get an armoured force to the Meuse River and Sedan in about 60 hours. Hmm. So they know it's possible. You find much the same thing with Pearl Harbor and all the rest of it. They know it's possible. They just don't think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Because various factors, this is the way they think it's going to be going. It's obviously going to be easier. The terrain is it's obvious. They have, slightly paradoxically, Enigma reports from Bletchley Park, helped by the French and the Poles, telling them the Luftwaffe are amassing predominantly for the thrust into the Netherlands and central Belgium, which is what the Luftwaffe is mainly assigned to, but it doesn't tell them about the army, which has got this armoured thrust prepped through the Ardennes. And this is what happens. And I mean, it's tricky terrain. It's forests. It's rivers. It's
but they manage to do it.
They do it.
Yeah, and that means the British army has to turn tail.
Yeah, and they punch through in a few days. Really, it's about the 13th, 14th. They cross the Meuse at Sedan. And it's then sort of free and clear out to just round past Calais on their big left hook round to the sea. And yes, lo and behold, the Northern Allied armies, the cream of the Allied armies indeed, are trapped in a pocket up against the sea by the German army.
So, I mean, in terms of getting them out, what is there a port nearby? Or there, what are the options of actually getting these troops off?
Well, it's a tricky one. Obviously, ports are absolutely crucial. And really, left within the pocket, you've got sort of three or four. It's predominantly Calais, Boulogne, Ostend in Belgium, or Dunkirk. And that's really your key options. Now, ports are obviously absolutely vital. By the time the Germans break through by the 21st and get through to the sea, it's fairly it's entirely obvious to the British that this is a problem. The British general, the Victoria Cross winning hero of the First World War, Lord Gort, has kind of seen what's happening and thinks we are probably going to have to get ourselves out of here. And he discusses this with London on, I think it's the 19th, and they put Vice Admiral Ramsay, the admiral in charge at Dover, in command of any possible evacuations. And they immediately sort of start looking at the ports.
So they want a port with deep water so they can get a big ship in, which can get lots of men on board. That's the principle, isn't it?
Absolute bottom line. It's simple, maritime logistics 101, as the Americans would put it. It's easiest to get large numbers of people straight onto a ship if you've got a nice sort of deep water port that you can tie up against a big jetty and they can just walk straight on.
Yeah.
It's that easy. If you've got to do anything else, like take people off of beaches, then it's obviously a large ship can't get in close. It's going to have to sit off the beaches some distance if it's shallow gradient beach and so forth. And you're just going to have little ships ferrying people to and from, and it takes absolute hours. So it's far, far more efficient for it to run through a port. And this is the key bit that certainly the Admiralty are looking at, although the army, Lord Gort stuck at Dunkirk, is sort of less looking at this. And when he sort of makes his move back to Dunkirk, they're primarily looking at beaches. And there's an interesting, fun little bit that I sadly never quite got to put in the book where he's got this fascinating character with him, a Royal Marine, young captain by the name of Jim Moulton. And he's actually, I think, the only Royal Marine to be at both Dunkirk and D-Day. Absolutely incredible career. Starts out as a gunner on HMS Rodney. Then he's going to something like anti-aircraft gunnery ashore briefly before becoming an aviator out in the Far East, and the fleet air on board, I think it's HMS Eagle, for 5 years. Then goes to Staff College just before the outbreak of war, and then gets assigned across to General Staff on Lord Gort's HQ. So he's had this incredibly varied career already, and he's been sort of sat in Gort's staff because I think he's about the only guy wearing green with aviator's wings. They assign him predominantly to talk to the British and French air forces. And then when they're retreating on to the beaches, it's sort of, oh, you're a Marine. You know about boats, don't you? you can go down to Dunkirk and sort things out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jim Moulton goes down and he sort of sees there's a bit of chaos going on the beach. Because the British have retreated to sort of what they call core embarkation areas just off the beaches. And the Navy haven't really got a clue as to where they are. So you've got ships arriving that aren't quite sure where they are. And so Moulton goes out and he talks to captain of one of these ships and discovers that there's a distinct lack of communication. And he gets permission to head across and brief Admiral Ramsay at Dover. So I mean, that's one part of it. But I mean, the other part of it from the naval side, of course, is that they actually start fairly early. As I mentioned, Admiral Ramsay's already got a certain amount of ships under his command already that have been supplying the BEF and putting troops over there and putting supplies over there and so forth. And things have started to accumulate really and start heading towards Dover from sort of 18th, 19th, when they start figuring out we might need to do this.
So what's wrong with the ports? Why can't they send the big ships to the big deep ports?
Well, here's the fun bit. Initially, they actually do start sending stuff out of Dunkirk itself. In fact, the French start an evacuation themselves on the 20th. They start getting what's known as useless mouths out there. This is all run by, incidentally, Admiral Ramsay's somewhat less known French counterpart, Admiral Abrial, who's the Amiral Nord, effectively the commander of naval forces north for the French Navy based at Dunkirk. So from the 20th, they're already starting to ship people out in large ships. Incidentally, just to sort of go back on the Dutch, there's a slightly tragic tale that they've got the remnants of the Dutch army there. They put aboard one of the first ships out on the 20th, and the Luftwaffe spot this convoy leaving, and they bomb the ship carrying the Dutch, which then has to be run ashore off Calais, and the poor Dutch soldiers, having escaped once, now find themselves popped straight into German captivity again within about sort of 24, 48 hours.
It's amazing how close the Germans are, but obviously there's a problem with the ports, which is why they have to take it to the beaches.
The key point, of course. The German army has arrived on the coast a little bit west of Calais, and they're starting to move in. So you've got the ports of Calais and Boulogne fairly rapidly start coming under attack. Now, in order to try to keep stuff running there, the British put across some forces, spearheaded by Royal Marines, but with army backup from a couple of army brigades into each of those ports. And they are there with the French to try and hold things up, and they sort of start, the Germans really start hitting Boulogne and really start trying to roll Boulogne up. And the British arrive, and it's really nasty within sort of a couple of days. They are forced to retreat. They sort of send out the Navy saying, come and get us. So, this is another evacuation before. And I mean, in reality, this whole series of evacuations and so forth that really sort of make up the Dunkirk story.
Yeah, that's the point. We know about Dunkirk, but there's stuff going on before, and there's a great deal of stuff goes on afterwards.
Absolutely,
as well,
yeah. So you've got the force in Boulogne requests permission to evacuate. They get permission to evacuate and get hauled out. The force in Calais, fairly shortly afterwards, find themselves in the same boat, and it starts to get a bit bloody, and they send the message home and start preparing to evacuate. And then, unfortunately, for the brigade that's in there, a destroyer arrives, HMS Wolfhound, I believe it is, carrying Vice Admiral Sir James Somerville, who is sort of acting as Vice Admiral Ramsay's deputy. He's been sent down from the Admiralty to sort of reinforce the command setup at Dover. And he carries, hand-delivered his message to the Brigadier, and basically, for the sake of Allied unity, the French have said no withdrawals. For the sake of Allied unity, you will stay.
Mm.
And the Navy send what they can. I mean, they put a couple of cruisers out there with their big 6-inch guns to just keep hammering away at the Germans, along with a flotilla of destroyers, and one of which I think is lost in the process. And they give them what support they can. The RAF, of course, are flying air cover, flying bombing raids, but all to no avail. And really, on the 26th, Calais collapses. At that point, also, the Belgians are looking shaky, and really, I think it's around 26th, 27th, they send a message to headquarters in France saying, look, we are going to have to surrender. So, realistically, Ostend is kind of out now. And besides which, the British Army has largely withdrawn on Dunkirk anyway as its nearest port. So we're down to Dunkirk.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Now, the rest of the ports have been sort of collapsed in on each other. And it's now down to this one port that is obviously now the key target for the Luftwaffe as well.
Sure, yeah.
So, the grand plan would be to, if they'd been able to keep sort of Calais and Boulogne open, they could potentially have got reinforcements in, they could have got supplies in, they could have maybe sorted out a breakout or whatever, but they couldn't hold those ports, and it's now down to Dunkirk, and it's time to go. And really, it's a couple of hours after Calais falls that the order is given to commence Operation Dynamo.
Right.
Which is the big evacuation.
And how many men are we talking?
Well, it's a lot, because the early efforts have really only pulled out, I think it was about 20 or 30,000 of the rear echelon troops, the supply troops and so forth. Rather more of the French have gone, but yeah, it's really about sort of 20, 30,000 have come out so far. And you've got really about 200 or so thousand British troops sat in there with another sort of 150, 200,000 French. So you are talking a lot of men.
Yeah, so there's a serious problem, which is when the call goes out to get every bit of shipping that the British can get hold of and to get them out there. So these, you know, let's talk about the little ships.
Yeah.
And how they actually fitted into the whole process. What was the intention to bring troops off the beaches to larger ships at anchor, or were they actually carrying troops directly across the channel?
Well, the little ships story is fairly fascinating. It's a complete coincidence. What they'd done around about the 14th, so this is around about the time that the Germans are making their big breakthrough at Sedan. The Admiralty puts out a call to particularly people in the southeast to say, you know, if you've got a boat longer than it's about 30 feet, could you come and register it with the Admiralty, please? Which
this has actually happened before.
So this has actually happened. Yeah. And this is not for any evacuation. They don't have any evacuation in mind. And as you said earlier, there's no grand plan no grand scheme in place to pull the British Expeditionary Force out. They just don't foresee this. What it's for is really to sort of have this list of little boats to just potter around ports, to take men off of ships for leave and liberty, and do little anti-saboteur patrols up and down harbours and so forth, just to put a couple of Marines on a boat to take pot shots at anybody and anybody randomly out fishing in the wrong place or whatever.
But it gives them a list, doesn't it?
But they've got this list now.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden...
I'd love to have been there in that moment when someone went, hang on.
Yeah.
I can put the two and two together here.
Yeah. And that this is what happens. The Vice Admiral commanding the small boats pool, a little known character, he is the guy who does this. I mean, he gets, you know, rightly, a considerable amount of credit for bringing this together. And obviously what they do when they order the evacuation, they sort of sit there and go, OK, here's our list, let's go and get them. And I mean, it's not just the civilian little ships that they've got on the register. I mean, literally, they're just going through everything in any sort of southern port, naval base, the whole nine yards.
Yeah.
So I mean,
and they physically they go and get them rather than expecting them to be delivered, don't they?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, yeah. There's a marvellous sort of famous case that one poor chap who spots his boat suddenly disappearing off up the Thames.
Thinks he's being nicked.
Yeah, he chases it up as far as something like Teddington Lock, and sort of I'm not sure whether he came across naval personnel or Ministry of Shipping guys, but it sort of, yes, sir, this is entirely legal. We are requisitioning this boat. Goodbye.
Yeah.
and off they go. And, they go in and say they nick stuff from warships that are in refit. Their lifeboats go, the Admiral's, Vice Admiral Ramsay's barge, his personal barge for Dover, gets taken across. Bunch of barges or scoots that have literally just evacuated out of the Netherlands a few days before.
Okay, right.
These are all sort of sat in southern ports around Dombey Pool, I think it is, and somewhere around there.
And there are a lot of sort of pleasure ships and steamers and, you know, the things of just people poodle around in the south coast enjoying the British seaside.
No, it's absolutely blasted everything. Lifeboats, there's a fireboat, tugs, fishing boats, and trawlers make up a huge sort of physical number of the ships, little ships that go out there. What else have you got?
Paddle steam, I think it's a paddle steam, isn't it?
Oh God, yeah. The paddle steamers are a wonderful little story. I mean, you get some of them are still in civilian garb, but a lot of them have actually already been taken up on the outbreak of war. Much like some of the trawlers, they're sort of taken up as minesweepers because they're marvellously manoeuvrable.
Oh, that's a good idea.
they're wonderfully manoeuvrable at slow speed, so they can just sort of inch their way into
spin around in circles.
Yeah, and try to avoid getting
using their paddles to hit the mines.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we've got this huge variety, it's kind of an eclectic fleet, which is the likes of which has never been gathered before.
Yes.
And off they go.
Largely, starts off really in dribs and drabs because obviously what Admiral Ramsay's got with him immediately on the 26th is predominantly a combination of about 30 or so destroyers and a similar number of what they call personnel ships, which are essentially the cross-channel passenger ferries and so forth that delivered. And most of these are literally the same ships that delivered the British Expeditionary Force across in 1939. That's really your sort of first wave. I think the first ship across there is... certainly the first ship leaving on the 26th, and this is actually before the order goes out, is a Manx packet. gets sent across the King Ory, which... goes in. I think they arrive just after the order's been given and haul some people off. And yeah, it's Manx packets and these cross channel ferries and ferries to Holland and all this sort of stuff. That's really your sort of first wave starting to go and get people. Initially, sort of predominantly trying to get them from the beaches because, as I mentioned earlier, the initial communication isn't quite there. So the army's not quite where the navy expects them to be, and so on and so forth. So, as well as the marine I mentioned, Captain Moulton, coming across, you get the British send across, the navy sends across, effectively, a team to start trying to organise stuff at the Dunkirk end, and slowly things start to put together and they start getting people out. And the key to a lot of this is, from the naval side, is Captain Bill Tennant, who is, in essence, certainly initially, Vice Admiral Ramsay's sort of representative in Dunkirk, the senior naval officer there, and he sort of arrives and starts coordinating things. And he predominantly embeds himself with the French headquarters at Bastion 32 in Dunkirk with Admiral Abrial, and they start getting that line of communication going, start getting people into the right place. The tricky bit initially is that a lot of Dunkirk, because it's been a massive target for the Luftwaffe for the last few days, is not in great shape. I mean, ports are tricky to knock out, but when you start having sunk ships in the way and so forth, it starts to get a bit messy. And obviously the French are kind of running, to a degree, their own evacuation at the same time as well. So a lot of the port isn't terribly usable.
Right.
And this is one of the key things that they are concerned with. So they're sort of sat there wondering, really, are we going to be able to do this? I mean, the initial projections, based on things like the weather and how long they expected Dunkirk to hold out, particularly in light of what had happened at Calais and Boulogne, they reckon they've probably got about 3 days. And if they're, if they're fairly unlucky, then they're probably only going to get about 35,000-40,000 out.
Yeah.
This does not look good, particularly when you've got nearly 200,000 in there. But Molly, shortly after arrival, Captain Tennant has this bright idea. He's sat out there in the harbour, his long breakwater called the Mole. In fact, well, there's two of them, in fact. There's an east and a west mole. And he sort of spots it. It's not structurally that sound looking. It's a wooden piling with a bit of concrete in it. And obviously, you know, you stick a sort of 1,000-ton ship up against something like that, and it's... Is it going to take it? Is it just going to collapse? But he sits there and thinks, right, we've got to try this. So he orders up this cross-channel steamer, the Queen of the Channel, to come in alongside, tie up and see if they could load off of this mole. And up comes this ship and ties up. Men go on. And lo and behold, yep, it holds. It survives. It doesn't collapse and crumble to dust. And all of a sudden, they've got it. This is kind of the key that cracks it. This is the way they're going to be able to get ships in and tied up to something such that men can just...
You can get hundreds off at the time.
Hundreds off immediately. And this is what they start doing, and very rapidly he starts ordering the ships to come in and tie up, and obviously they send messengers out to the men behind the beaches to start hauling into Dunkirk as fast as they can. And really what you're after there is, obviously, it's almost this sort of railway line principle of something turns up, you fill it, goes. Turned up, fill it, goes, and obviously at the other end arrives, unloads,
turns around,
refuels, rearms, heads back, and all to as close as you can get. Which, let's be honest here, it's not going to be terribly close when you're in a combat situation. Everyone's getting bombed and all the rest of it.
Sure,
but it's as close as you can get to almost a timetable. And the guy responsible for that is one of Admiral Ramsay's staff, Captain Michael Denny. And I mean, they really do phenomenally well with it. It's quite incredible.
Yeah, working like a timetable. It's a really good way of thinking about it. So that's what's happening. They're removing people in their hundreds from ships from this sketchy mole. And then are those ships being attacked by German torpedo boats or U-boats or aircraft? What's going on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a dangerous place to be as the channel. The key dangers, actually, initially is minefields, and a goodly chunk of those are in fact, the Allied minefields.
Right, okay.
Chunks of which they have to start clearing before they can get at least one of the key routes open. Because they've got three key routes to go down. One of them... out to the east and down, one sort of fairly straightish through the centre, and then one out to the west and round. To get round, obviously, the minefields and sandbanks and so forth. So
they clear the minefields, but then they've got the Germans to deal with. Then, because the Germans certainly know what's going on.
Oh God, yeah, the Germans are. I mean, famously, of course, the German army has been ordered to halt for a couple of days briefly, and Goering, head of the Luftwaffe, says, it's fine, I'll deal with it, not a problem. And, the Luftwaffe heads in and starts bombing the hell out of the place, bombing troops ashore, trying to bomb ships at sea. Not, in many respects, terribly successfully with the latter. It must be said, the Luftwaffe was not really set up as an anti-shipping force. They're not terribly good at it at this point.
We've got to remember it's still early on in the war, and also bombing ships is a remarkably difficult thing. And I think the point is that there's a big, you know, there's a big gap here. Where's the German Navy?
Yeah, there's the interesting bit, of course. The German Navy is there, but only in a comparatively small way. The key thing that the Germans are deploying are these little motor torpedo boats known as Schnellboots or S-boots in German, or E-boats to the British for enemy boats. And these are nasty, deadly little things with large cannon on and a couple of 21-inch torpedoes that can obviously sink a major warship if they strike. I mean, they're small, they're fast, and 40-odd knots.
Yeah. But there are no German warships.
Yeah. And the E-boats are key because the rest of the fleet, such as it is, has largely been committed to the invasion of Norway.
Yeah.
This is where the big ships are, right throughout the whole of the Dunkirk evacuation. I mean, the Norway invasion has taken a lot. It's really the German Navy's operation. The entire fleet had been detailed to the invasion to actually execute it. You've got a lot of their sea lift, their transport shipping is committed to it. They even have to take troops in on cruisers and so forth just to unload them on quaysides in Norway. And it's where they suffer an awful lot of losses. I mean, their destroyer fleet was never... the German fleet as a whole was never that big.
No.
At this point, it's literally there's a couple of battleships, half a dozen, maybe eight cruisers, 20 destroyers. Now, of those 20 destroyers, 10 of those are destroyed in the battles of Narvik, particularly. They also lose a couple of cruisers. I mean, the British submarines under Vice Admiral Sir Max Haughton wreak considerable havoc. The pocket battleship Lützow gets struck by a torpedo partway through the, heading back from Norway, and... her stern just falls off. It's fairly shocking.
Anyway, the Germans are not there.
The Germans are not, apart from the E-boats. Yeah, the Germans are predominantly... The German Navy is predominantly dealing with Norway.
Yeah, okay.
And that's where the two battleships head just after the Dunkirk evacuation is completed. But, yeah, their main... effort really is the E-boats, and to a degree, I already mentioned the minefields. You've also got the RAF, of course, that are there potentially to cause problems. You've also got British motor torpedo boats as well. If you're sending big ships in there, it's not really a healthy place to be anyway. Yeah. So it's really kind of a battle suited to these smaller coastal forces, and this is what they engage, and these things are pretty deadly. I mean, there's was it the 29th is a particularly nasty day where you get U-boats and E-boats attacking all in one area, and you get one destroyer that takes a torpedo, sinks, rescue ships turn up, pick up various survivors. One of the rescuing destroyers gets hit by another torpedo. First one was from an E-boat. The second one is from a U-boat. And there ends up all sorts of mess. And the Royal Navy are really getting quite concerned. The ship's there. And they end up with a rather unpleasant friendly fire incident in the middle of all of this, because it's just so it's dark. This is the middle of the night. They've lost one destroyer, one other destroyers in a bad way, and it's it's a mess, and yeah, it's a really quite dangerous place to be.
Yeah, it's really important to remember just how uncertain it all was. It's one of these campaigns where we know what happened.
Yeah.
You know, but to put yourself in the middle of it. So you've got the big ships working off the mole, and then how do the little ships fit into this?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the little ships are really there to ferry people to the bigger ships from the beaches, because really there is an uncertainty with the mole. It may get bombed at some point. You get concerns about it being closed. You get people just not really able to shift in, space concerns, all the rest of it. So you get a number of people being brought off of the beaches, and this is what the little ships are there for. They're sort of towed out. They are crewed by naval crews from predominantly from the Chatham barracks, sent across. You do get the old civilian crewing their own ship, of course. And they're sent across, and they are there to ferry people out to the bigger ships, and the bigger ships then take them back across.
Yeah. And once all of the people are off Dunkirk, then there's another operation that carries on after that, because there are more French soldiers that need to be taken off. It kind of goes on and on, doesn't it?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, you have to bear in mind that once Dunkirk is completed, there's still something like 200,000 British forces still in France. Plus, of course, there's the French armies, the Polish armies as well. And they're all sort of sat in there. And as the German forces suddenly swing west again and start moving back up the coast to invade the rest of France, you suddenly start seeing what is Operation Cycle and Aerial, which are the two big evacuations after Dunkirk. And these essentially start just moving up the coast Le Havre and Cherbourg are the two big ones.
Basically moving west,
cycle, yeah, and as you move out, that's all done under Admiral Sir William James out of Portsmouth. As it moves into the far west, comes under the Plymouth Command, Admiral Sir Martin Dunbar Naismith, VC, legendary submariner of the First World War, and yeah, they have to basically drag the rest of the British Army out of there. And I mean, you also have to bear in mind that even with Dunkirk over, Churchill promises additional troops, and a couple of divisions actually start making their way across. You get these two divisions arriving under the command of Lieutenant General Sir Alan Brooke, who turns up at French headquarters and within a day or so, and realises that this is it, this is over, we're done, and has to get on the phone and have an absolute blazing row with Churchill. And Churchill sat there saying, no, you've got to stay, you've got to stay. And Brooke saying, no, it's over, we've got to get out or we're going to lose the army. And Churchill in the end relents, and obviously operations Cycle and Aerial are the end response. And it all ends really, in actual fact, just after the French signed the armistice on June 22nd. And it's
a month after, Dunkirk.
Oh, God, yeah. And it actually ends with the evacuation of the Polish armies out of Saint-Jean-de-Luz.
Really?
Down near the Spanish border. Yeah. And that's really the final evacuation from France. And there's almost a sort of poetic element, I suppose, that the war really starts with an evacuation of the Polish Navy from Poland to Britain, and that first sort of phase really ends with the evacuation of the Polish army to join the Polish Navy in Britain as they leave France just after the 22nd, around the sort of 23rd, 24th, 25th.
Yeah. It's such a magical story, isn't it, where you've got civilians essentially coming to the help of a professional army. Do you think that's why it's retained its fame and interest?
I mean, it's 1940 is such a sort of epochal, seminal, call it what you want, year of incredible events. And this is, of course, one of them. So, I mean, was almost guaranteed a sort of place in the Pantheon, but it's got this great cachet to it. As you say, it's this image, however slightly exaggerated, of, as you say, civilians coming forth in the great films that you get of starting really actually in the war itself with Mrs. Miniver in 1942, where the husband of the titular heroine gets on his little river cruiser and volunteers to go across and comes
back. So it was picked up really early.
Oh, God, this sort of Dunkirk little ships bit is picked up incredibly early. And obviously you get that through the 1958 film with Bernard Lee, later to become M in the Bond films, and Richard Attenborough as, again, a couple of civilians going across, and out as recently as 2007 with the 2017 rather with Christopher Nolan's recent film with Mark Rylance as Mr. Dawson, who's very heavily based on an actual character, is the fabled Charles Lightoller, who incredible guy, who was the senior surviving officer on the Titanic and a pioneer First World War aviator and so forth. A genuinely incredible guy.
What an amazing job. Amazing life.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
He's very much based on that. But it is that great story where it's got that romantic amateurism to it, and it's all compressed into this one area, one word, Dunkirk, and you can just sort of nicely put it all together as this grand story.
Well, Phil, thanks so much for talking to me today. And everyone, if you're listening and you want to find out more, read Dunkirk and the Little Ships by Philip Weir. It's published by Shy Books, and it is a truly excellent little book. Phil, thanks so much.
My pleasure entirely. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you all so much for listening. Now, do please follow us on social media. The Society for Nautical Research is on Twitter and on Facebook, and the Mariner's Mirror podcast has its own YouTube page, which has got some fabulous new innovative ways of visualising the past, and also everything is posted on Instagram. But best of all, please do take the time to check out the Society for Nautical Research's website at snr.org.uk, where you can join. Please, please join us, and your subscription fee, modest as it is, will go towards publishing the most important maritime history and towards preserving our maritime past.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.